Hi, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Brian Balgi, and it's good to have you here with us for our U.S. Open preview show, which is actually a little late, but you can still listen to it anyway. We are presented by BetDSI.com. You can use BetDSI.com's odds every week like we do, including this week for the U.S. Open. And we love using those odds because we get to see how the money moves in real time and how it affects the odds on the board. And as we said, we use them every single week, even if you're in a jurisdiction where you cannot legally bet on sports. You can use BetDSI's information to give you a sense of where the money's moving, smart money and dumb money, and help you make some intelligent choices for your fantasy lineups. So head over to BetDSI.com. All right, so as I mentioned, this is our U.S. Open preview show. We recorded this yesterday in pieces. Will Haskett is our guest, and you probably know Will from PGA Tour Radio. He's a broadcaster extraordinaire. He is also an excellent golfer, a scratch-caliber player. I don't know his actual index, but I'm going to guess it's close to zero. And he does columns for us, and he does GNN Live with us, as we've done that over the last year or so. And I wanted to have Will on because of a variety of different reasons. One, he's a great guest. Two, he's a great guy. Three, he's a good golfer. Four, he's played Erin Hills. And there aren't too many people that are covering the U.S. Open this week that have actually played Erin Hills. And even if those people are covering the championship, not many of them have the golf skill that Will Haskett does. So Will's such a great guest, and wanted to have him on to do a preview. And we kind of wound up doing this in two parts, in part because we had a little medical issue with my daughter yesterday. She's okay, nothing's wrong with her, just a little freak out. So we've pieced together kind of two conversations into one in the afternoon, one later in the evening, and believe it or not, they actually flow together really well. So I don't know why I actually told you the difference, but nonetheless, I think you'll enjoy this. And just as you kind of get ready to watch the Open today on Thursday, or as you watch it even on Friday, I think a lot of this will still be applicable. So enjoy the conversation. We'll come back at the end.
Will, we're so glad you're on the podcast. We probably should have done this way sooner than we've done to this point. We've done GNN Live together through the major championships the last couple of years, and that's been a blast. And this is a little bit more of a relaxed setting. And this is a U.S. Open, which doesn't necessarily lend itself to being relaxed, but this is a little bit of a different venue. It's Erin Hills. It's a place that's never hosted a U.S. Open before. It's hosted two USGA championships previously. Basically, nobody in the field, short of the guys that were in the 11 amateur, know what this golf course plays like. But fortunately, we've been there and have played it. So obviously, we didn't play from 77-41, and we certainly didn't play it from 83-48, which is the max length that they can stretch this thing out to. But for people who are going to tune in on Thursday and see Erin Hills for the first time, or even are still trying to figure out this place 3 days into U.S. Open week, what are your general impressions of Erin Hills, and how do you think it'll play as a U.S. Open golf course?
I think it's going to be great, and the reason why I say that is because I think it was built to be great. And the thing that I think is great about this golf course is that I really do feel like players have options, and it's crazy to say that when I do think bombers have a little bit of an advantage. I think 7,700 is a bit extreme, but I understand it with the runouts and the way that you can chase shots. But because there's no tree, there's one tree in the entire property, I just love the fact that guys have options. Like, you know, you can springboard some shots off of some of the areas. You know, Rory McIlroy did such a good job yesterday discussing how the fairways are so wide. Let's not worry about the fescues. Positioning can be in play here. I'm not saying a short hitter has an advantage mentally, but I'm saying that even if you're not a big bomber off the tee, you're still going to be able to find creative ways to get in position to score, to survive, to avoid the pitfalls that this golf course has. And I think, Ryan, the thing that's weird to me, I don't know how I would define this golf course in terms of its strength. You know, like when you say, is it a first-shot golf course, a second-shot golf course, is it a combination of the two? I don't really know which aspect of the game is most important. What I do know is if you get out of position, you will get penalized. So if you're hitting it long but you're not hitting it straight, you're done. If you're hitting it short and you're keeping it in the right spots, you're going to be in play here. That's the option that I like in the golf course. It's a great walking course. It's a great spectator course. It's got natural amphitheaters. I think it's going to play beautifully this week. And guess what? It's green. So we don't have to worry about brownouts like we've had, you know, 2 years ago, which I think was the big problem aesthetically with Chambers Bay. So it's going to look good, too, to the eye. I'm excited for it.
I think there is a natural thought because Erin Hills is an 11-year-old golf course and Chambers Bay is similarly young to try to compare the two because there aren't a lot of trees on property. There's one tree for both that's potentially in play, and they're both modern courses as opposed to the U.S. Open, and obviously the contrast in color, like we've talked about, is pretty stark, using bent on the tees and greens and having just beautiful green fescue that the USGA did not screw up and that Aaron was very cooperative with in shutting down the golf course basically from the end of 2016's playing season until they opened it back up for this. But I get the sense that maybe isn't the appropriate comparison. Now, what do you think about, because next year's host is Shinnecock Hills. I want to tell people this is basically what Shinnecock Hills would look like if they built it 10 years ago instead of 112 years ago or whatever it is. Would you agree with me on that?
Yeah, because there was as much of a bulldozer used on Erin Hills as there was on Shinnecock 100 years ago. I mean, they didn't really touch much of the dirt at all. I mean, really any of the dirt that was moved at Erin Hills was done after the original construction when they looked at some of the blind shots that there were and said, okay, look, there's some places where we need to shave some stuff down here because it's just a little bit too wonky. It's a little too crazy from some of the vantage points that they had, and they re-sculpted a number of the holes, typically on the back part of the front nine of the property. So I think that is a fair comparison. And I think another thing with Shinnecock, too, is, you know, unlike what we saw in Chambers Bay, where a lot of those greens were set sort of low and in places where if you missed greens, it wasn't as penal. At Erin Hills, like at a Shinnecock, you know, you've got a lot of these sort of tabletop sort of greens where when you miss, you're going to be in sort of lower collection areas or in these, you know, hairy little bunkers that just sort of swallow balls. It's very much like an Open Championship feel from across the pond, where if you roll it off that edge and it just kind of drops down into the sand and there's no run into the flat of it. I mean, it wherever it sits is where it's going to stop. You're going to have some crazy bunker shots from some of the guys around the greens and in the fairways because of how those bunkers are sculpted. So, yeah, I think it's a fair comparison. It's a throwback American Link sort of course like you would see on Long Island or some of those places where it's been shaved down. And in talking to the architects, I mean, 95% of the golf course is exactly the way they found it. I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of property that the USGA recognized very early on, even during construction, was going to be perfect to host a championship like this.
Now, in that sense, I think that the green complexes are a lot like what you see at Pinehurst number 2, which you kind of have, if you miss it, it's not quite turtleback. It's not quite to that extreme, and they're bigger, generally speaking. But I think these guys are going to have so many options that it's going to flummox them, whereas you and I, you know, if we went to go play either Erin Hills tomorrow again or we went and played Pinehurst number 2, we would just hit the bump and run. Like, that's what you would do because that's what the caddy tells you to do, and that's the smart play. But these guys
– Texas wedge, Ryan. Texas choices. Wedge all day long. Texas wedge.
Yeah.
Don't give me a wedge.
Exactly.
I just want my putter the whole time.
Exactly. And I made that mistake playing Pinehurst number 2. The one time that I did play was, I'll just get out the sand wedge. I'll put it up to here, and it'll run out. It'll be great. 5 holes into it, I was like, don't give me that. Don't give me it again. I'll just bump it. It's fine. We'll take care of the rest. And I get the sense that – and we talk about this all the time about professional golf tournaments or majors, is when you give players options, that's when you get them. And I think that's what they've got here, and I think that's why I believe this is really a second-shot golf course. Because if you fail to hit the green, then you open up all of the problems that this golf course really has. Uneven lies and bunkers, really weird options for your recovery. You've got difficult shots to greens that aren't necessarily scary, but if you don't put them within a reasonable 10-15-foot radius with your next shot, your putt is pretty tricky. I mean, that's why I think about this golf course. Like you mentioned earlier, you didn't know if it was a first or second shot golf course. I think predominantly it is a second shot golf course.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And the only way I would disagree isn't because I think, for you, me, and anybody else that goes out there, you have to be able to put the ball in position and give yourself opportunities. I think as this championship evolves and where the guys have a benefit is that those that can dominate the first shot are going to have the greatest opportunity. So while I think the golf course's strengths are as a second shot golf course and position, and I wrote about this in the piece where I have continued to pick Dustin Johnson as the guy to win it this week, it's that Dustin Johnson's ability with the first shot in his bag gives him the opportunity to be better with the second shot at a higher percentage than everybody else in the field. So I think that's the one place where Erin Hills is a little bit susceptible, is that those freaks of nature can get themselves in positions because of the width of the fairways to have a greater advantage in the second shot. But you're absolutely right. If DJ blasts it all over the place but can't wedge it to the right spot, then he's toast. But if he's hitting that wedge from 65 yards closer than everybody else in the field, the odds say he's going to put it closer and make that second shot a lot easier. So we'll see how that all sort of plays out with the guys, you know, during the course of the championship. But you're right. I think it is a second shot golf course. I think for the U.S. Open, I'm waiting to see the first round to see just how much of an advantage the first shot is for those guys that dominate that club.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. The weather forecast is a little iffy. We've had rain a couple days already this week. We're expecting a little bit more tomorrow, maybe some Thursday, maybe some Friday even, and then it kind of clears up nicely for the weekend. But there is the possibility that rain has softened this place, that the rollout won't quite be the same with driver, that maybe some of the green complexes will have softened a little bit and open up some possibilities for high ball hitters to have a distinct advantage. But that kind of segues nicely into the kind of guys that we think that could win this championship. And you alluded to it earlier that if you're hitting a 50, 60-yard golf line, it doesn't matter how far you hit the ball. You will lose. It's just not going to work out for you. But if you keep the ball in play within reason, which, again, in this golf course would be 50, 60 yards wide, you have some opportunities to do some things, even on the par fives, which might be three chatters for the short guys, but you're a wedge away from an up and down for birdie. So do you think that they're is a small subset of players in the field of 156 that can win, or a larger subset than a usual U.S. Open?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's the beauty of the unknown of this week, since we really don't have a track record of what it's going to take to be successful. And I would almost piggyback on a secondary question, and I've actually argued with myself on this one, because it's so much easier and fun to argue with yourself than anybody else, because you always win. Is that it's the first time we've had a U.S. Open that's a par 72 in 25 years. I mean, it's been since 1992 at Pebble that there was a golf course that was going to have this many par fives available to the field. And I actually don't know who that is an advantage to. Like, the natural reaction is, okay, the guys who are long hitters that can get it on in two, the more par fives you give them, the chance to make eagles, that's fine. But to me, it almost, I think, helps out some of the guys that maybe do take it in a third shot hole, the great wedge players in the field, because they're not going to, those are holes where it's almost easier for them to manage mistakes and give themselves birdie looks than the guys who are bombing it and could perhaps run into some of those troubles around the green. I haven't made up my mind whether being a par 72 necessarily helps the big hitters in the field. But back to the original question, I think you have to look at the guys that just annihilate the golf ball. And while Dustin Johnson's in his own sort of stratosphere, if Rory is healthy, if Jason Day's progress is where we think it kind of is going, we've seen at least glimpses of him being better, you know, those are the three guys that can play a different sort of golf course with the talent that they have. And if this golf course is truly what we think it is, then the odds are that one of the three of those guys wins this golf tournament. But again, I want the early returns. You know, I want to see what the first wave does on Thursday before I really say, okay, yeah, you know what? It is totally DJ's advantage. I'm saying it right now because that's the way that I think, but I have nothing to base that off of except for a little bit of gut feeling and the fact that we've seen this type of golf course get annihilated by Dustin Johnson before.
Now, the one thing I will say for Chambers Bay that maybe is something we can carry over here to Aaron Hills is that ultimately the best players did float to the top. We had Jordan Spieth, we had Dustin Johnson, Jason Day with Vertigo, we had Patrick Reed, Rory McIlroy and Adam Scott both backdoored their way into contention on Sunday, so Louis Oosthuizen. So we had a really great board in the end at a place that no one knew really anything about other than, again, a U.S. amateur, and nobody really knew how it was going to play because it was so burnt out ahead of time. So my hope is that, again, the unknown will work out, that not knowing how this place will play plays to the advantage of the better players who, if you just stick them in Antarctica, they would find a way to play good golf. You know, they'd figure out how to play from the ice and around the penguins. So I'm hoping that the same thing happens here and that you get at least a good board. It doesn't have to be monster hitters. It doesn't have to be all the top 10 in the world, but then we get a good board. And I think that to what you were saying, Jason Day seems like the perfect guy for this. And I say that because he's peaking at the right time. Obviously, he had personal things to deal with his mother's lung cancer diagnosis earlier in the year, and I'm sure he still is dealing with issues related to that, but he seems more engaged in golf. I know he booted the four-footer to give Billy Horschel the Nelson. That's fine. I took more heart in that he had a great finish at Memorial, his best ever finish. He's been terrible at Memorial, where he has playing privileges, of all things, and he finally figured out how to get around there. I think his game is encouraging, and on top of that, he has more top 15s in this event in the last 6 years than anybody, including Dustin Johnson. He's got five of them. And on top of all that, this place is going to be really slow on Thursday and Friday. The time par is 4 hours 52 minutes, which, for people who don't know what that means, that's basically the expectation of your round from the USGA, which is, they kind of say with a wink and a nod. So we're talking 5 hours 45 minutes for rounds on Thursday and Friday. Guess who that works for? Slow-ass Jason Day. So
yeah,
can you kind of evaluate what you think of Day, and you saw him play Memorial in person. What do you think you've seen from him of late?
No, you're right. And his finish, I mean, he wasn't involved in the weekend at all, but the fact that he was on the weekend was breaking news for him at Memorial, so I agree with you that I think it was important that he showed a little bit of form in a place where, even though he can practice there, he's never really performed well in the tournament. I'm still a little gun shy of the putt you mentioned in losing to Billy Horschel in that playoff, that shove four footer. It just isn't the same Jason Day that was a top 10 putter when he rose to being number one in the world. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a rep thing. I don't know if it's a mental thing. I don't know if it's just, you know, reverting back to the mean after having a sensational hot streak with his putter. You know, I just still wonder, and I'm not saying it's short misses, I'm just saying the whole body of work, does he make enough putts? Because Jason Day is a guy who, even when he was at his best, he wasn't the most accurate. He could bludgeon a golf course, and what he did at Whistling Straits was absolutely phenomenal, but he's going to get himself into a couple of places of trouble. And the putter was bailing him out of that in those spots. So whereas, same thing with Rory McIlroy right now. I mean, Rory is at his best, he's making putts, and he's really kind of an average putter when he's, you know, not winning tournaments on a regular basis. So I think it still boils down to all of that with those guys, and I've written about it too with Dustin Johnson. Like, his putter sort of has disappeared over the last, you know, few outings of it. But to a guy like Day and to the best players in the world, I mean, it does come down to making those putts, and I think we will see a loaded board when it's all said and done, because I think this golf tournament now, with the strength at the top of the game of golf, lends itself to having the best players in the world all rise to the top when it's all said and done. So maybe it is one of those guys in which everyone makes the most putts. But I think that if you're looking at trends, Jason Day may be the one that's actually trending of that big three, big bomber trio, to the top of the list.
I want to talk about Rory for a little bit, just because he has so much intrigue around him every time he seems to play in a major championship. For the second straight one, he has overhauled his entire golf bag. I mean, the Masters only did fairway woods. But this time he's got 14 new clubs. He's got a new putter this week. He's been injured. He says he's got full authority, full medical, to go ahead and do whatever he normally does. But those are not only the question marks that he has. It's that, other than the win in 2011, which really was not on a true U.S. Open setup, Congressional's new greens were weakened before they had to overflood them to keep them alive. It was just not a U.S. Open. He has a terrible U.S. Open record otherwise. And it doesn't seem to make sense with how good of a driver of the golf ball that he is. And he talked about on Tuesday saying this tournament has gotten his head a little bit. So now the Masters is in his head and the U.S. Open is in his head. This is a mean question, but is Rory McIlroy mentally weak?
Yes. And I mean that in the nicest sort of sense. Like, the more I think this is like a huge case study. I'm fascinated by the killer mentality in athletes. And I wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago on GNN about that sort of same thing. And this generation of athletes across all sports really truly lack that in a lot of senses. And, you know, what made Tiger Woods great was he wanted to kill the guy walking next to him down the fairway. You know, what made Jack great was he wanted to do it sometimes out of spite because of how poorly he was treated when he came out as a 22-year-old. Arnold Palmer had a huge chip on his shoulder and an axe to grind and something to prove. And a lot of these guys necessarily don't. Now, we see angry Rory from time to time. I kind of appreciate the candor and the calmness that he's shown so far this week. But, you know, I think the guy that actually has the most fire of the young crew, and it's is weird to say, is Jordan Spieth. He doesn't necessarily show it externally, but that kid burns in a way that I don't think people really truly recognize. And he's probably the one that has the most shortcomings when it comes to the arsenal of weapons, because he doesn't have that overwhelming power and maybe sometimes that incredible dynamic precision. He's just got the best short game in the world, along with probably, I think, the biggest killer instinct. So I'm not going to say – I'll say, yes, Rory's mentally weak, but not in a – I don't think he's standing over a four-footer and his knees are shaking. What I mean is I don't think Rory has necessarily gotten comfortable enough in his skin to say, I'm the guy that needs to put the entire game right here on my shoulders, and I will – me personally will take this trophy and take the game to the next level. You know, if he had Dustin Johnson's ability the last couple of years without the injuries, and I think someone would argue that he's better than Dustin Johnson, but DJ has shown us something. I mean, just imagine what then he could do with that, like that sort of transcendent power, not just the beautiful ability that he has. I don't know. I don't know if Rory has officially arrived at being comfortable with Rory yet.
So you mentioned Jordan Spieth, and he's obviously the 2015 champion. Frankly, Dustin Johnson should have been the 2015 champion, and he should also be the 2016 champion. So in one sense, Spieth kind of luck-boxed his way into his second of two majors in 2015. He isn't the best driver of the golf ball. He's certainly not the longest driver of the golf ball. And we talked earlier about how this is kind of more of a second-shot golf course, but the first shot sets up that second-shot opportunity. So how do you assess Jordan Spieth's chances?
I mean, I want Jordan Spieth to win as many majors as possible because that's how much I believe in his game. But there's something loose about him right now. I just don't trust Jordan Spieth the way that I trusted Jordan Spieth 2 years ago, or maybe even last year when it wasn't that great of a year. And I can't pinpoint necessarily inconsistencies. I mean, the errant shots off the tee, and maybe this is a good week for him. I mean, maybe 60-yard wide fairways help him, especially now that they've gotten so much rain that it's going to be softer, that he won't really be out of position in places. But there's just something there where, I mean, I don't know, Ryan, do you trust Jordan Spieth, more than the top 5-10 other guys in the world? I mean, I don't know. There's something about him where it's like he doesn't roll off my tongue now as, oh, yeah, that's the guy that's going to win. And look, he's got the best short game in the world. I'll argue that until he's 45 years old. But I don't know. Like, there's just something that's missing from where he was 2 years ago. I don't know if it's swagger. I don't know if it's, maintaining a tighter swing with the long clubs in his bag. I don't know what it is, but I want to say that he's going to perform well this week because of creativity and it being a new golf course. And short game will really carry you around a venue like this because of all the interesting shots that everybody's going to probably have to play around the greens. But, Ryan, I don't know. Like, do you trust him?
No, not particularly. But the thing I do like about him and the thing that might serve him for a long time at majors, even long after his tremendous short game skill erodes, which, by the way, could happen literally at any moment. I mean, we don't know how long that lasts. Just think about how great Tom Watson was, and then at like 32, it was gone. So what I do trust is that he's an incredible grinder and that he does have the ability to play through tremendous spells of holes where he can't hit a fairway, he can't hit a green, and somehow he makes threes and fours and fives, and all of a sudden the guy playing with him, more often than not, seems to be Rory McIlroy, goes, how the hell is this guy beating me? And that gets into the opponent's head as much as it helps Spieth out. So I think he still has that. I think he still has that gene. But he doesn't seem to have the gear that you were mentioning where he knows he's better than everybody else, even though he really isn't. And he knows he's going to win the golf tournament. And with that missing, I feel like that's a huge liability in any major championship. And then on top of that, he now knows just as much as everybody else knows that Dustin Johnson is better, that Rory McIlroy is better, although he seems to be in Rory's head, that Jason Day is better at his best. So at best, he's the fourth best player in the world in terms of talent. At a certain point, that's a problem. And also, the further he gets away from that last major championship, so now we're 2 years away from a major championship, the further away he gets from that, the more he has to think, was that my best year? Is my best year at 2015? And will it always be 2015? And I think the longer that goes, the worse it is for him mentally to ever get back the swagger you were talking about.
You know, and I think the nail you hit on the head the most in that breakdown of where Jordan Spieth is right now as a player is that scar tissue. You know, is there scar tissue? It's hard to think that there would be, because we were worried about scar tissue from him before he ran off two majors. And now after the fact I think it's the same expectation with Rory McIlroy. You know, he got the four, he's pumping and puffing his chest that, okay, I've gotten a four, but then all of a sudden when there are guys that are coming along, you're like, oh, you know what, at Dustin Johnson's best, I think he's better right now than Rory McIlroy. And so, yeah. You know, is all of a sudden, do you see bricks going into the ceiling that Rory McIlroy was going to be busting through past four into five, six, seven, eight major territory? And the same thing with Jordan, which is ludicrous for us to talk about with guys that are all in their 20s who have won multiple majors. The one thing I did like about it, and I don't think people are really thinking about this as much this week, because we expect the scoring to be better than a brutal test like maybe Shinnecock will provide as in years past, where I don't think par is necessarily going to be in contention to win this golf tournament. We think it's probably going to be hovering somewhere closer to 10 under par than even par. But at 7,700 yards, all the steps they have to take, as slow as the rounds are supposed to be because of that, Jordan Spieth's mental game, even though he can get a little bit fidgety out there, it's an endurance test, not just physically, but mentally. And that eliminates a lot of guys, including a lot of really good top players in the world when it comes to 72 holes. So if it turns into more of an endurance test, and I mean that in all senses of the word endurance, then maybe Jordan does have an advantage there, because I don't think there's anybody in that young crop of players that can focus down and grind for 72 holes the way that Jordan can.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And as we talked about earlier, with 5.5 hour rounds, 5 hour, 45 minute rounds, you've got to be able to just know when to turn it off and turn it on. And he seems to be able to do that better than anybody in the top 10 in the world. And if that's what it comes down to more than anything else, then that's certainly a leg up in his column. So let's move to John Rahm, who obviously was a low amateur last year at Oakmont, T23, I think it was. And in the nearly a year since he's become a professional, he's done everything that you could possibly expect of someone. He's gotten into the top 10 in the world. He's won. He's contended. He's had two really good battles with Dustin Johnson in different events. And Dustin Johnson wound up winning them both, but Rahm did not really relent in either of them. This is a little bit different now. Obviously, the Masters, he got himself into the fringes of contention on Sunday and then just kind of petered out. The same expectation seems to exist for him in the U.S. Open. He's long, he's straight, he's got a great imagination, really good short game. He's also got a firecracker temper, where if things don't go his way, maybe he will lose that mental acuity and all of a sudden kind of be the anti-speed and inject himself. So where do you see Rahm going, and how do you assess his first year as a professional?
I think we need to pump the brakes on Rahm, and I mean that with as much respect as I can put into it. I think he's done what we expected him to do because he was that good in college. He was that good as an amateur player, and he's translated it at a young age to where it is. But you know, the way that he burst onto the scene, the way that he won early, the way that he competed in World Golf Championship events, you know, as a young professional, you know, he still doesn't have a top 20 in a major. Now, I understand that that's a small sample size, and I don't necessarily think that Augusta, as a professional earlier this year when he was red hot, is the best golf course for him. But I think that there's something to – look, I think he's got a lot of learning to do. You know, his frustration, and I remember him, you know, his comments after the round in Memorial earlier this year when, you know, he was sitting there talking about and he told a great anecdotal story to, you know, one of my colleagues on PGA Tour Radio. He's muttering to himself coming off a green saying – you know, I had a putt that was, you know, tracking on a good line to the hole, and someone from the gallery shouts, "Get in the hole," like shouted a positive word of encouragement to his golf ball, and the ball dries up short. And he was frustrated because he thought the guy talked the ball out of going in, like, "Don't talk to my golf ball." It's like, dude, you have got to pump the brakes, like settle down, you know, figure out where you are as a professional and mentally going here. I just think he's a little bit too rattled to where, again, if it's an endurance test this week, both mentally and physically, I just don't know if Rahm's there yet. An incredible talent. He's going to win a major. But this week, right now, I just don't see it happening.
The last three guys you talked about, we all came to each of them a similar conclusion. There is something wrong with their head, that they are either losing swagger, that they're too nice, they're too out, they've got other things going on, they get too riled up easily, whatever it is. Is that a symptom of this generation of players? And I know, again,
yes,
we were trying to make a broad statement about guys who are in their 20s, who have a long way to go before the book is finally written on them. But for being in their 20s, and for being guys that are superstars, are they not as strong mentally as the prior generation, Tiger excluded?
I mean, I'm convinced that weak is not the right word. That's unfair to guys. I mean, I think these guys can deal with pressure. It's not about being able to knock in a 5-footer on the 72nd hole to win a golf tournament. I think a lot of these guys have proven that. To win at this level, it has proven it. But I think to be the absolute best, and history shows this with the greatest athletes of all time, whether it's golf or in other sports, is that you have to have this mentality where it is you against everybody else, and you will do whatever it takes to beat everybody else. And I'm not necessarily sure a lot of these guys carry that same. And there's a lot of factors that go into it. We can, you know, throw out the generational argument. You know, the game of golf now is so lucrative. You know, these guys don't necessarily even need the win in a major championship to validate their career or add a couple of extra zeros to their bank account. There's ways to market yourself without ever winning. Like, I think Ricky Fowler is one of the greatest interviews and one of the greatest human beings in professional golf. But the amount of money he's made marketing compared to his level of success on the golf course is one of the greatest discrepancies in the history of the game. You know, more power to him, but I don't think it's made him a better winner. It's made him a better marketable athlete. It's made him a better product. It's made him a better pitch man. I don't know. I don't think we're going to see too many people tighten it up. I mean, there are very few guys that are wired that way. Patrick Reed is wired to be a guy from two generations ago, but his game and a lot of other things are probably going to prevent him from being the consistent force that we would really like him to be. I mean, he would be the antagonist to the group. Unfortunately, his game isn't anywhere near the top 5-10 guys in the world right now on a consistent level to then be that sort of antagonistic personality in the game.
And we seem to have kind of that, a larger crop of that guys than maybe we should have. In a sense, that's bad. In a sense, that's great. We've got guys like Reed and Koepka and Justin Thomas and Ricky Fowler and Matsuyama. You can go down to like Tyrrell Hatton. I mean, guys who are in their 20s that we think should do some fantastic things at some point, but on a major stage have not done it for a myriad reasons. There's some flaw in their game. Physically, there's some flaw in their game. Mentally, they don't close tournaments well. They don't putt well. You name it. Is that, from a marketability standpoint, since we're talking about that, is that a bad thing? Is it bad that we have guys that are really good, that we tell people are really good because in golf we understand what really good means, but that they don't close the deal very often, and they certainly haven't done it yet on a major stage?
I don't know if brands necessarily care about that. As long as you win at some level, then you're a winner.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to take advantage of the rewards that come your way from that. You know, but think about this. We were having, or would have had this same conversation on this very podcast a year ago, talking about Dustin Johnson, about his mental inability. And he's a guy. It always was crazy to me, because if there's ever an individual who just seems to block out every distraction around him, it's Dustin Johnson. I mean, the man has blinders on, I feel like, every time he plays. But then when it came down to big tournaments in late moments, something just cracked. Something finally broke through the fog of whatever's between the ears for DJ. And then he won, and it just kind of propelled him to something different, whatever that level of confidence was in him. So, I mean, we're one win away from completely erasing and backpedaling a lot of these different comments. But from a marketing standpoint, I don't think anybody necessarily cares. It's about brand. It's about what sells. It's about the attractiveness of who you are and how you represent yourself. And I think winning is lost a little bit. But I will say this. You look at the most marketable golfers of all time, and they were really great winners. And while these guys are getting fat checks, the longevity of their marketing. Are they marketable when they're 50? Are they marketable when they're 60? Like, Tiger Woods may never play another professional golf tournament, and if anything happens positive in his life, he can still make more money marketing in 20 years than most of these guys will when they reach their 50s and their 60s, unless they become an all-time great. So I think winning has the ultimate separator from the greatest earners to the guys right now, and that's where somebody could separate themselves a little bit. But right now, I mean, the guys are just all so cool. They hit it far. They've got some flash to them. And, you know, if you're the best, you're going to find a way to make money.
You hit the most critical nail on the head, I think, about everything that we've said here pretty much in this entire podcast, is that it only takes one. It only takes one win to change everything, to make Dustin Johnson pre-open into a Dustin Johnson post-open, and that we could have a totally new view of all, any or all of these guys a year from now. But that also at the same time, you got to capstone that by saying that also is fleeting, and that that could go away just as quickly as you got it. So that's the difficulty of our sport, right, is trying to figure out what's different between having a good week, a good year, and a good decade, and being able to predict that seems totally impossible. So with that said, let's try to figure out the guys who kind of slide out of that obvious crop and could have a great week instead of a good year or a good decade and pull this thing off and pull it away from the guys that we think are going to win. So who are some of the guys that no one seems to really be talking about that you might have your eye on and really like?
All right, there are two Swedish players in the top eight in the world, Henrik Stenson and Alex Noren, and neither one of them are going to come anywhere close to winning this week. But I just wanted to throw that out there, that they're two guys that no one's going to talk about, and I think that's probably worthy that no one's talking about them because I don't think either one of them have a chance at winning this golf tournament. You know what? I keep going back and forth, and we talked about it earlier with, I still don't really know if 7,700 yards and four par fives and a par 72 lends itself as favorably to the big hitters as I want it to believe. But because there's so many unknowns, I just have to stick to my guns on this one. So I still want to look at guys that blast the ball. I think a name that we're sleeping on is Thomas Peters. And the reason why is he hasn't played. Like, I mean, he was great at the Masters. He played the BMW PGA on the European Tour. And from official counting events, that's pretty much it. Like, I mean, the guy has been a shadow most of this year, but he annihilates the golf ball. He's riding this sort of heater of performing in big moments. So you've got between the Ryder Cup and a couple of top fives with great fields this year in Mexico and then at the Masters. There's something about the way that he fits on this golf course, the way that he can crush a golf ball, that I think he at least needs to be in the conversation. I think Justin Thomas needs to be in the conversation. He's just walking around like a different player right now, not just because he won earlier, but I think he's really settled into understanding how good he is as a player. A very comfortable demeanor to him right now. Even with, you know, I walked with him for 54 holes at the Memorial, and, you know, he didn't play his best to have a chance to win on Sunday, but wasn't discouraged necessarily by it because it's all sort of part of the process leading up to what he expects now to be a major moment for him. So I think he's getting close to being able to bust through to that. And you know what, a weird dark horse for me, and I keep going back to him a lot of times because of the way he strikes the golf ball, but if we want to talk about driving, but then second shots, you know, Paul Casey. You know, he's top 10 on the PGA Tour in approach. He's been right there in the mix. I don't necessarily know if against the best he has what it takes to finish first, but if he's on the first page of the leaderboard every day until Sunday and cracks the top five when it's all said and done, is anybody really going to be surprised? No. Like, I mean, he is clipping the ball over the last really 2 years better than almost anybody else and is always right there. And I just think he's never going to be out of position on this golf course. So those are the three names, I guess, that I was looking for breakthrough guys. But let's be honest, I wrote it for the site. I think DJ wins going away no matter what happens. But, you know, if someone else is going to break through, I think it could be one of those three guys for their first time at the major.
Yeah, I think you kind of framed it right in your column, which was it's DJ versus the field. And you can easily eliminate half of the field that's not DJ before they show up. You could probably eliminate another third of that half that's still left before they show up because the course is either now going to play too long with rain or it's in their head that it's going to take 5.5 to 6 hours to play. I mean, for a variety of factors. So really, truly, there are probably 50 guys who can win, and we probably have mentioned 10 of them, 12 of them. So we're most of the way there. The only ones that, I mean, among many that we didn't, but some that I really like. I like Charles Schwartzel a lot, and I would not have said that 3 weeks ago. And I say that because, obviously, I'm, you know, kind of recency bias of, hey, he should have won Memphis and gave it away to Daniel Berger, which, fine, that's fine. But he has an extremely good U.S. Open record, and I don't understand why, because Masters champions and U.S. Open guys don't always seem to be one and the same, but he seems to get it, and I want to get a sense from you, from anything that you have from on-the-ground observation or even anything that you've heard, that is that misplaced? Is that trust kind of stupid to throw in a guy that, again, is kind of like Thomas Peters, except 10 years, 12 years older, where he doesn't play all that much. He tends to win tournaments where you get to go super under par, and then just shows up over here a couple times a year and puts up some top 10s, rakes some cash, and goes back to doing nothing.
So this is where I go back to my, when you're around the game for so long, you develop your own scar tissue. Like, I felt like Charles was the guy that I would just ride in these sort of segments for years and years and years, and then you get burned by it enough that you're like, oh, really? I mean, I want it to just roll off the tongue, because they're, you know, because Charles just rolls right off the tongue so easily. And I don't know. I mean, you're right. Like, it's top three and then a couple of weeks of nothing, and then top five and then a couple of weeks of nothing. And he settled sort of into this spot. I mean, if you just hit the over under on somebody on where Charles Schwartzel is ranked in the world right now, they'd probably take the over on whatever number you gave them and be woefully wrong. I mean, he's 16th in the world, and I don't think anybody even really understands how that's possible, because he just hasn't been in our consciousness during all of it. But I don't know. I mean, I look at him and a Louis Oosthuizen and some of these guys that have won these majors, and I think they're actually more built for a U.S. Open than necessarily the majors that they won. Like Louis, the way that he won at St. Andrews, and Charles, the way that he won at Augusta, I think those are more outliers than necessarily where their game would promote them. But you're right. Like, I mean, Schwartzel hits it on a rope, and he's very precise. But again, he relies on that putter, and I don't know. I think he'll make a couple of mistakes around greens. He's a good player. I don't necessarily know if the creativity is there enough around the greens, because I don't think he's going to have as many looks as some of the other guys. But I mean, he's 16th in the world. I didn't know that until 5 seconds ago when I looked it up, Ryan. Like, somehow he's a top 20 player in the world. Who knew?
As much as I agree with you that we should fade Sweden, I am in on South Africa for this championship. I am in on Schwartzel. I am in on Oosthuizen. I am in on Brandon Grace, even though he's needs to find train yards. I'm in for all of those guys. I think South Africa just is built to win Opens, and I think that if DJ stumbles, then our you know, bridesmaid could be Jason Day, who steps in there, and then after that, I think South Africa is ready to conquer.
I mean, Brandon Grace has 3 top fives in majors over the last 2 years, or 2 full calendar years, I mean, including, you know, a great run at the U.S. Open, you know, a year ago. So, I mean, this is a guy that, you know, has the game. I'm not necessarily saying as of late that he's the guy, but, I mean, yeah, you're right. It's a country that produces, you know, incredible winners, and this is a tournament that I think is now starting to evolve into one that is an incredible winner. And not to completely derail the conversation, but I was even thinking about this earlier today. With the way that golf has become so top-heavy, I almost feel like the U.S. Open has become the best major in terms of winning value. Like, the Masters always gives us a great champion, because I think it's always very limited in terms of who can win the tournament, so you don't really get you know, off-the-wall sort of winners. You can always have a weird U.S. Open winner. I mean, Lucas Glover, for God's sakes, won a U.S. Open. I mean, that to me still is, you know, it is unfathomable. But I think now the golf tournament has really evolved into, if I was a professional golfer, this is the tournament that I would want to win the most. Like, if I really wanted to puff my chest out more than anybody else in the locker room, walking around with a U.S. Open championship, to me right now, is the best win in golf. Now, the last couple of years have been crazy from a USGA PGA perspective, it hasn't been the tidiest tournament to necessarily win. But if I wanted bragging rights in the locker room, I think being U.S. Open champion right now is the best feather in anybody's cap.
I can't disagree with you. It's been on a good run of winners. It's been on a good run of performances, even if all of the noise around it has kind of been diminishing, maybe in a professional view to what this tournament means. But in the broader scheme of things, when we look back on this 10, 15 years from now, it's going to be like, wow, this was a great run for the U.S. Open. This really meant something. And then once the PGA Championship moves to May, it'll definitely even boost it a little bit more, I think.
Oh, that's a different podcast. I can't wait. 2019, can't get here fast enough. It's going to be awesome.
Oh, cannot wait. Cannot wait. But you're right. That is another conversation. So I'm going to end with this. Not the PGA moving to May. So I'm going to end with major championship in Wisconsin. And I don't know how to answer this, so I'm just going to kind of throw this blindly out there. How the hell did Wisconsin become five golf state in the United States?
They're crazy about it. I mean, the only way I can really point to it is, I mean, as a Midwesterner, and I guess Wisconsin kind of gets thrown into those of the rest of us, I mean, more of a Great Lakes state. I think it's because we get so little great months of golfing weather that the folks that do play become so passionate about it that there's just this uproar of support. Now, what we've gotten with Whistling Straits and now with Erin Hills and that is that there's just some incredible natural land to build on. Now, Whistling Straits is a product of Pete Dye and a bulldozer, unlike, as we talked about earlier, Erin Hills and just finding a really good piece of property and building a golf course on it. But I think the vistas of it, and if you go across, you know, Lake Michigan, I mean, there's some incredible golf courses on the eastern side or the eastern shore of Lake Michigan as well that are major championship quality venues as well. They're just really hard to get to, so you'll never see big tournaments played, you know, up north in Michigan. I think a lot of it has to do with the land. I mean, you've just got places where, you know, you think of the golf-hungry places in the United States. Florida and Arizona are terrible topography spots to build good golf courses. You know, you take advantage of the natural contours of places like where the glaciers carved their way through Michigan, Wisconsin, and some spots. You just build great golf courses. I can't wait for this week. I mean, I think Whistling Straits is good. I don't think it's great. I think there's actually a better piece of 18 holes on that property if you're ever visiting up there. I mean, I think what Black Wolf offers is a better golf course than Whistling Straits, but that just shows how good the property is in that area. But, you know, as much as the players are talking about Erin Hills this week, you've got another destination in Wisconsin, but just a product of good golf courses and, you know, good for the state. But, you know, there won't be another Greater Milwaukee Open anytime soon, but I think the Cheeseheads will gladly take a major every 6 or 7 years over, you know, a regular PGA Tour stop.
I agree with that. My last question is, and I think I kind of know the answer to this based on the history of the USGA and Erin Hills, but more so, I think, than Chambers Bay, which was kind of square peg, round hole. I don't know if Chambers Bay will ever get another U.S. Open, but I'm pretty sure Erin Hills is going to get another U.S. Open unless this is a total disaster, and I don't think that's going to happen. Do you think that's the case?
I do. I mean, David Fay told the architects when he first saw the property that it was meant to, and I'm talking about Erin Hills, that it was meant to host major championships. So it's gone through all the evolutions that it needed to do in hosting a U.S. Amateur and hosting a women's pub links, you know, and having, you know, all of the lead up to it. I don't foresee anything happening this week that would damage the reputation of the golf course. We'll see how the tournament itself plays out, but I don't see any reason why they wouldn't go back to it. I'm a little upset that they've caved to the, you know, the players whining about the fescue and that they hacked some of it down. I mean, I think Rory's, you know, we should just, you know, post and pin to the top of all of our social media feeds Rory's comments about how, look, if you can't hit these fairways, then don't bother showing up to the golf course to compete in a major championship. I mean, I think it makes perfect sense. But, no, I think it was – look, Chambers Bay ran into a bunch of horrible luck. And as much as I would love to just throw 2015 completely under a bus and back that bus over it five or six times, there were some circumstances that made it more difficult for the folks managing that golf course. But it still isn't a piece of property that was always going to be perfect for it. I think Erin Hills has always been a better piece of property to host this championship. You know, now we'll see, you know, what the golf's governing body here in the United States decides to do with it for the next 4 days.
All right. I think we've pretty much covered it all, wrapped it up pretty nicely. Now that the thing gets underway, let's go DJ. Let's get a second U.S. Open title and let's see something good happen. Let's be right. Let's be right. So Will, thanks for coming on. This is awesome. And we'll definitely have to do this again for more majors.
So when DJ shoots 78-78, how quickly can we run and hide somewhere in the hills?
We'll delete this podcast. Yeah.
Perfect.
It'll be like Snapchat for audio. This will not exist. It'll be a funeral.
Cool, man.
All right. Thanks, Will.
Thanks again to Will for being on the show. He is awesome. He was a great guest. Honestly, made me consider thinking of having a podcast with just Will and me talking every week about golf. The flow was great. The takes were great. Oh, it was wonderful. It was one of the best podcasts that we've done in a while. And I mean that with some of the high caliber guests that we've had on this show. The banter was just great. It was perfect for a podcast. So hopefully you enjoyed it. Hit Will up on Twitter at Will Haskett, WILLHASKETT. And you can find his work, of course, on golfnewsnet.com. Follow us every which way on your favorite social media channel at Golf News Net. Follow me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. We will be tweeting, covering, doing everything that we can to bring you the 2017 U.S. Open from Erin Hills and make it as enjoyable of experience as possible for you, the fan, watching remotely. Next week on the show, we will go over the U.S. Open, who won, who lost, how did it all work out, how did Erin Hills do, and everything else that we talked about with Will over the course of this podcast. Be sure to give us a 5-star review if you have a chance. If you listen to us through iTunes, it helps us reach more people, and we always appreciate that. If you have Roku TV, download our Roku TV channels, just called Golf News Net, and you can join the thousands of people who will watch our videos on their actual televisions, which is pretty cool. All right, until next week, I'm Ryan Ballingy saying thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the 19th Hole Golf Show.